Now, in the history since the Middle Ages, which we have studied, we have seen three main movements. There are three main movements which has formed what we call, or what we can call, the Western mind. That is the thoughts and attitudes of men in the West. Two of these main movements we have already discussed, the Renaissance and the Reformation. To the third of these main movements we must come now, the Enlightenment. Now, what does the Enlightenment mean? Surely there is nobody here except myself who hasn't thought of himself as enlightened. But by the 18th century, I don't think of myself especially enlightened. On some things I'm damn prejudiced. As Freud said so rightly, the first step for betterment is to have insight into one's own illnesses. Now, by the 18th century, the word enlightenment had quite a definite meaning. It meant a conscious attempt to throw away what they considered old ideas and old traditions. And above all, a conscious attempt to put an end to that force which to them symbolized old ideas and old traditions, Christianity. By and large, the Enlightenment rejected Christian theology and substituted an emphasis on the critical mind. What are the underlying forces of this Enlightenment? First of all, the rise of science, coinciding with the exhaustion of religious passion in the religious wars. Second of all, a more rational approach to religion itself, to try to demythologize religion. And thirdly, a revival of the classics, for the ancients helped to destroy old ideas. The Enlightenment, as you will see in more detail, went to the ancient as an inspiration against Christianity, against the outworn ideals which they wanted to destroy. I listed the rise of science first because it is perhaps the most fundamental, and it is the rise of science that must occupy us today. It was, like all such movements, a very slow affair. It starts in a way in the Renaissance, but it does not really get going until the 17th century. To be sure, basically, science emphasizes an inquiring mind. What that means is that it had to reject reliance on authorities and make observation the source of knowledge. That was difficult, and that took a long time to throw off the imitation of authorities, biblical authorities, Christian authorities, and to put an equal weight upon the truth of one's own observation. But we must be careful here, quite careful, because what the Enlightenment called superstitions made a contribution. They rejected astrology. They rejected alchemy. And whatever you say about alchemy and astronomy, they are still necessary. For alchemists and astronomers believed that man's mind could unlock the keys of heaven. And however mystical their conclusions were, however opposed to scientific method, it is all important that during the Middle Ages and into the modern period, there were people, alchemists and astrologers, who believed that man's mind was important and that man's mind could penetrate the secrets of nature. But what comes with it after the religious wars is what we might call a greater pragmatism. In your source book, you will read part of Thomas Spratt's History of the first great scientific society, the Royal Society of England, founded in 1640. And you will see what he means when he writes that these members of the Royal Society wanted to get away from the passions of the age, from the theological questions, from that kind of thing which seemed to lead to excesses and war. For the Royal Society was founded in the English Civil War, and they knew what they wanted to get away from. And instead, they wanted to go to experiments and observation, to get away, as they put it, from the madness of the age, a madness they blamed on religion and the religious wars. What it meant to go to experiment and observation was what they called free inquisition. That is to say, a mind untrammeled by prejudice, as they thought of it, but that, of course, only from a contemporary point of view. For really, there is nothing without ideology. And when they thought they were getting away from theology, they were really getting into another kind of worldview. That worldview was also connected to the ancients, but not to Aristotle, but instead to Plato. For in the Renaissance, and I told you this once before, you have a revival of Plato and of Platonism. And for Plato, and I repeat this, the universe is not hierarchical. The universe is a kind of pantheism, a kind of pantheism to which the human mind can penetrate. And it is not the hierarchical universe of Aristotle, at least not in their mind. For Aristotle had been Christianized in the Middle Ages. And therefore, Aristotle's worldview had become ordered and limited within decipherable limits, an immobile earth surrounded by the heavens. But Platonism seemed to give a certain fluidity, for the whole universe is suffused by God, and there are not these definite kind of limits that Aristotle had. Therefore, Platonism helped to get a more fluid world picture. And that world picture was encouraged through a series of definite discoveries, which I won't stress because you will read about them, by astronomers, by physicians. And when you look at these discoveries, which came out of the experimentation, they have one very important thing in common, whether you think about the new theory of the planets or Harvey's discovery of the circulation of the blood. They discovered that everything was movement, that the planets were moving in a certain way, that the blood was circulating. And in the first part of the 17th century, therefore, experiments seemed to discover the idea of movement, which destroyed the static idea of the Aristotelian universe, a universe in motion rather than static. Motion becomes essential to the nature of the universe. And this movement is subject to mathematical laws. For Plato had believed that mathematics was the way in which you could discover the universe, in which you could penetrate the fluidity of the motion of the universe. So that, through these experiments, through the influence of Plato, the universe was in movement, subject to mathematical laws. The nicely ordered and Christian heaven was attacked. But the man who put the capstone on that attack was Galileo. For Galileo, not only in his experiments, but also in his writings, did this. He attacked the whole idea of immutability, of lack of change. And he put forward a theory which was revolutionary, though you have it in some alchemists already, namely that motion is a mark of perfection. In the Christian universe, immutability is a mark of perfection. God, Christ, the angels, immutable. The biblical text, immutable, static. But for Galileo, the perfection was now in motion. He sought to show that it was nobler to change, to create anew, that change was everywhere, that the universe was, in short, infinite, and that the notion of infinity is better than the notion of immutability, more perfect, more satisfying. Now, there's one old idea that he still holds on to. For how does he prove that infinity is more harmonious? He proves it by the fact, I'm sorry, that it is still harmonious. For these people tried to keep the doctrine of harmony, and the harmony of the universe, and the harmony of all matter, and the symmetry of the universe. But they tried to fuse that with the idea of motion and infinity, so that you had both harmony and motion, and that harmony was not merely linked to being static, not merely linked to a Christian and Aristotelian universe, but for a universe in motion. Kepler, the discoverer of the motion of the planets, called his famous book of 1619 Harmoniae Mundi, the harmony of the world. But harmony was motion. Harmony was infinity. But how could you capture that? Through mathematics, and especially through geometry. Now again, this didn't come from nowhere. It is influenced by the revival of Plato. It is influenced undoubtedly by the Baroque and the kind of fluid style of the Baroque, which we have discussed before, for it coincides with the Baroque and its influence on movement rather than its influence on static, as you have in Renaissance and classical symmetry. It is also connected with alchemy and astrology, for alchemists had also believed that there are many heavens beyond our heaven and that man can penetrate them. But never had it been so clearly put that infinity is harmony, that infinity can be noble. The man who came to symbolize the translation of these scientific ideas into the realm of thought more than any other was Descartes, whom you will read in your source book as well. You will see in Descartes a greater sophistication than in Bishop Spratt. For Descartes, a working scientist, a geometer, did not believe that free inquiry alone will do the trick. He did not believe what many early scientists, but not Galileo, believed, that heaping experiment upon experiment will lead the truth. There must be hypotheses first. Galileo had already put forward this modern scientific method. What is Descartes' answer? It is a two-stage answer. First of all, in common with this impetus, you must sweep away all acquired opinion. And how do you do that? Through doubting everything. Part of the Cartesian revolution, as we call it in human thought, is the introduction of the primacy of doubt. You must doubt everything. Through such doubt, Descartes believed that everything can be reduced to its mathematical and geometrical proportions. In other words, if you doubt and doubt and doubt, eventually you will come to mathematical formula and geometric formula. This also Plato had believed, that the basic comprehension of the universe was in mathematics and geography. But once he had done that, he faced the principal question. How do we know we are not misled? You doubt and doubt and doubt. You reject Christianity, and he goes in your source book through all the things he rejects, and you arrive at some geometric formulations of the universe. But granted all this, how do you know that you're not misled? That, of course, is the great question. And it is the second extract in your source book which gives the important answer. For what is involved is, how do we know whether our thoughts are true or false? There is no relativism as yet in all of this. They still wanted to get at truth. They believed in truth. So how do we know that our thoughts are true and false if we have doubted so long? The answer, of course, is God. And here Descartes makes an all-important assumption about God, which will be general throughout the Enlightenment. Descartes' God is no longer the hidden God. It isn't the God who spoke to Moses from the burning bush. It isn't the predatory God who descends and punishes and then goes up to the heights again. Descartes' God is the God of geometry and mathematics. He is, as he puts it, the God who gives you distinct and clear ideas. And distinct and clear means ideas that you can formulate in mathematics and in geography. The argument is that if your ideas are distinct and clear, if you are sure that your ideas are distinct and clear, then your ideas must be true, for they are of God. For God would not give you any ideas that were not themselves distinct and clear. God is the God of reason. God is the God of reason. Religion, therefore, is rationalism. Religion is not theology. It is not theological speculation. Religion is something you come to by doubting and by using your reason. Descartes here went beyond science to a religious development, which I have no time to indicate more, to do more than indicate, to certain religious trends which had always believed that reason is a part of the religious approach. The people whom we call Unitarians and Arminians, above all. But these people had also believed that there was revelation, the revelation of Christ, and that at revelation, reason stops. Well, with Descartes, reason doesn't stop. God himself is reason. Therefore, revelation, Christ, has no part in this universe. Christ has no part in this. God is, as it were, pure reason. That is why we call this view of religion by a special name, of which you are aware, why we call it deism, from Deus, God, which means that there is only God. God and your reason. There is no need for Christ. There is no need for redemption. How do you worship God? How do you worship God? You worship God by exposing his laws. But not his laws of the Bible, his laws of nature. You worship God by exposing, through scientific methods, rational methods, the operations of nature. For there is, as you have it with Plato, in this idea, what we call, and I told you once before, pantheism. That is, God is everywhere. From a leaf in a tree to a cloud, everything is God. And here, everything is a rational God. If you want to understand nature, you doubt, you use your reason, you arrive at clear and distinct ideas. This is the way to worship God. I can illustrate it perhaps by giving you a title of the most famous Dutch biologist of the 17th century, Swammerdam, who wrote, and he didn't mean it as a joke at all, a book by the name of The Beauty of God as Revealed in the Flea. Sir Isaac Newton is a very good example, for when Newton found that the sunspots were not working in the regular harmonious way that you could capture by geometry and mathematics, Newton appealed direct to God to right this blemish on his universe. Disorder was not a part of this. The universe was rational. It was still ordered, though it was infinite, but it was ordered by reason, mathematics, and a geography. Now, this Cartesianism, as it is sometimes called, has several consequences, which again are basic to your understanding of the Enlightenment. First of all, it rejected theology. It went to deism. Christ, the Trinity, these are all superstitions. Second of all, it believed in a universe infinite but still harmonious, a universe not chaotic, because they combated the idea that infinity means chaos. Not chaotic, but ordered. But ordered on a different than the Aristotelian Christian hierarchical model, ordered in regard to the laws of science. Thirdly, it meant essentially that with the right rules of with the right use of reason, man is a rational creature. There is in all of this, and if you think about it when you read your Descartes in the source book, I think it'll be quite obvious. There is in all of this a presupposition about man, an optimism about man. All men are rational creatures. God has formed man in his image, and God's image is pure reason. Therefore, every man is a rational creature. Every man can discover, therefore, the beauty of nature if he goes about it in a rational and scientific manner. Therefore, you have here an optimism about man's potential. Fourthly, you have the emphasis on the critical mind. Doubting is very much a part of that, but there are limits to doubting. This is not a pure skepticism in the classical Greek skeptic. There is a limit to doubting. In other words, I have illustrated what I said at the beginning. They thought that they were going to free expression and all of this away from the old superstition, but of course they landed in a superstition of their own, if you like, or preconception, namely this preconception of a rational universe and of rational man. Finally, if it is true that all man is rational because God is rational, that he doesn't jump out at you from a burning bush, but that God is indeed rational, then it follows that there must be a leaning, at least a hope, that all men must be equal, because all men are equal in capacity. There is therefore no original sin. There is very little room for the Christian original sin here, because Christ doesn't really enter. It means a leaning towards equality, not as saints, as you studied it during the English Revolution, not as saints imbued by the Holy Spirit, but as rational creatures. Secondly, this belief in equality means a belief in religious toleration. But that belief in religious toleration and what it means, I can best explain to you if I tell you the only fairy tale that I will tell you during this entire course. It is a fairy tale which comes to us from the Renaissance, first from Boccaccio, but which was taken up and adapted in the Enlightenment by Lessing, the great German Enlightenment writer, and which became, this doesn't mean you all relax, if I say fairy tale, you all relax. We should have acted it out. You can, because it is a very famous play. It is the center of a very famous play. But quite apart, what is this fairy tale? And it tells you, I think, more about the toleration and what the Enlightenment meant on this level than everything else. Now, I will interpret the symbolism to you. What I shall say, the symbolism, first of all, obviously. When I talk about the ring, it's the true religion. When I talk about the three sons, it's Judaism, Mohammedanism, and Christianity. Can you remember that, children? Judaism, Mohammedanism, and Christianity are the three sons. The ring is the true religion. Once upon a time, well, I'll tell you the setting too. Nathan the Wise is the play, because I think that tells you good. Nathan the Wise is the famous play. Some of you may know it. Nathan is called to the Sultan, and the Sultan says to Nathan, Nathan, you must become a Mohammedan, or you will have your head chopped off. But there's one thing. If you can convince me why you shouldn't become a Mohammedan rather than remain a Jew, then I'll let you go. And Nathan replies with this famous story, which is taken from Boccaccio. There was once a man who had a ring, and the main feature of this ring was to make every man who had it especially beloved by his fellow men. And that ring was passed on from father to son, from father to favorite son for generations. Eventually, however, there was one man who had this ring, whose quality was to make you especially beloved by all men, who had three sons. Remember what they stand. Three sons who were equally beloved. So it came on his deathbed and he said, what shall I do? I have three sons and only one ring. So he sent for a goldsmith and had two rings made, which were just like the original ring. And he couldn't tell the original ring from the other two rings. And he called on in one son after another to his bedside and he said, son, I gave you the ring, which will make you beloved by God and man. The man died, the sons met and started to fight each other because everyone had said he had the ring. And finally they went before a judge and that judge said, this is an easy problem. Come back in 1,000 years and who has actually made himself more beloved by God and man? He has the true ring. Now, this story has several morals. One moral is, of course, that the test is not theology. The test is pragmatism. And you get already in the Enlightenment the growing pragmatism, which will eventually be so important with Voltaire and others. The growing pragmatism, the growing pragmatic ideas, that if it works in practice, then it must be right. You get a growing pragmatism. Secondly, you get with this growing pragmatism, the test is practice. You get the idea of the equality of all men. There is no judgment here made. Which one is inherently better? Christianity, Judaism, and Mohammedanism. They are all equal. And thirdly, the test is equal for all of them. It isn't whether Christ is true. It is instead who has made himself most beloved by God and man. The play, not to lead you in suspense, ends that way as well. It turns out that the Christian who is the villain of the play, he is a crusader. You see, he is the villain to spread religion with force. That the crusader, the Christian, the villain of the piece, is really the brother of the Sultan, and that Nathan is in reality, if I am right, also a close relation. But I now forget what. Oh no, Nathan's daughter Miriam is a close relation to the crusader, isn't it? Anyway, it turns out that the Jew, the Mohammedan, and the Christian are all closely related. It ends in the 18th century opera buffa way, which you know from your Mozart and opera librettos. They are all closely related. Therefore, again, the religious difference does not really matter. They all go on and do good. I'm sorry that I've forgotten their complicated relationships at the moment. Now, what you have, therefore, here, then, fifthly, in the famous story of the three rings. None of you knew this story? No? But this all came to America. I mean, we think there's nothing to theology. You think everybody's equal. I was here at a wonderful meeting once where my great friend, the theologian Tillich, spoke, and the presiding officer, one of our colleagues in philosophy, turned to this leading Protestant theologian and said, "Well, Professor Tillich, don't you really think all religions are really alike and all they want to do is good?" And Tillich simply answered, "If I didn't believe in Christianity was the truth, I wouldn't be a Christian theologian." And that was the most un-American statement I'd heard for years, I thought. What you have, therefore, I'm surprised you don't know this, because this is very essence of this kind of ethos, which also came over here, of the Enlightenment. Now, finally, with all the ideas of equality, with all the ideas of the Sultan and Nathan and the Crusader, whose name now finally escapes me, we can still not say that the Enlightenment was a democratic movement. Why not? Why not? Because, by and large, from Descartes on, they believed one other thing, which I haven't mentioned, that you must first bring out the rationality in man, and you bring it out by education. That is why the Enlightenment was so interested in educational theories. That is why, like the humanists, they had educational theories, some of which we shall mention, and they were interested in them. Therefore, it meant for them that there must be an elite who does the educating. Therefore, by and large, the Enlightenment was an elitist doctrine. And it was an elitist doctrine of intellectuals. For in the 18th century, we get a great bifurcation which will last in all of modern history. And it is of vast importance. For on the one hand, we will have the intellectuals who believe in the Enlightenment and who try to spread it. We shall see a little more of them next time. And on the other hand, you have the masses of the population. And what were they doing? They were supporting the other great movement of the 18th century, the evangelical movement, which you know from its English end as Methodism. They were supporting the great Christian revival, emotional revival, opposed to much of what I have told you. So that between the intellectuals and the people, the masses of people, there came to be a very deep gulf in the 18th century. The Enlightenment was a doctrine of intellectual coteries, an important one, because in the last resort, the intellectuals will determine the cultural atmosphere into the next century. But for the mass of people, it was the revival movement, Pietism or Methodism, which became, in fact, one of the modern mass movements. The Enlightenment was not destined to be a mass movement. I don't have to tell you, you can't base a mass movement on mathematics and geometry and on reason. Well, that is more disputed, I know. But history at least seems to prove you can't. And the 18th century is an interesting example that there were these intellectuals, whom I shall talk more about, talking about rationalism, mathematics, and Plato, and there were the masses going to their revival meetings. I think there is a lesson to be learned, perhaps, but I won't tell you what it is, because for one thing, I want to go on to the evangelical movement and more of the Enlightenment and that dichotomy next time, and you can think about it a little bit. I think it goes very much to the roots of very many modern problems. The Enlightenment is the beginning, with humanism, of the history of the intellectuals. And as that is your history and mine, it is not unimportant. The history of the intellectuals. And the history of the intellectuals is a different history in many ways than the history of the mass of men. As I say, it is your and my history. And therefore, it is not unimportant to see that what has lasted in intellectuals is the humanist tradition, the tradition of the Enlightenment, all intellectual coteries, all elitist intellectual coteries, who will determine the cultural pattern but not for much longer. Much for not longer. Then December Bride will win. Oh, you don't watch these television programs. I'm sorry. That was an anticlimax. That was an anticlimax. Well, anyway, what I'm telling you now is a hypothesis, because historians proceed like scientists. They make hypotheses, and I am making that hypothesis. But the meat of the hypothesis, I think, begins in the 16th and then with the Enlightenment. For put two things together. Put together what we said about the humanists. There were the humanists, and then there were the mass of people engaged in various kind of Christianity, usually of the more emotional kind. And then in the Enlightenment, you have again an intellectual coterie, the three rings story, all of that. And on the other hand, you have the evangelical mass movements. I dare say it would be true to say that the history of intellectuals diverges from the history of the mass of man. First in the Renaissance with humanism, then with the Enlightenment, and certainly in the 19th century, you might see next term, very definitely as well, with certain intellectual movements, until in the end, the division, I think, becomes extremely great. Here I will end for today, because you may have questions, as you are intellectuals. One other thing, the identification which many people make, I think myself rightly, but it is also a product of history as everything, between intellectual and critical mind comes from this period, and that will remain, that the main thing that an intellectual has to be is critical, and a critical mind comes very largely from the heritage of the Enlightenment, from this intellectual coterie. I think there can be no doubt about it, and it is a definition in the 18th century general, that the intellectual is above all a critic. It's above all a critic and an actor, because you'll see that next time. Yes?
I'm trying in my mind to